From the Northern Confluence Initiative, this is 54 Degrees North. Northern Confluence is dedicated to conserving the salmon watersheds that sustain our communities, economies, and shared futures.
The Fraser River is effectively being used as a sewer. And Estilo and the Tsokotin have both been opposed to this. And despite having lots of concerns about the water accumulating, and that's its own issue and needs to be dealt with, but using the river to meet the water quality guidelines is of real concern.
You can't be holding reconciliation in one hand and a mining permit in the other hand and say, okay, that doesn't work, you know, so there has to be true talks, and they have to recognize our loss.
Hi, I'm Nikki Skuse. Welcome to my podcast, 54 Degrees North. We just heard the voices of Chief Lassise and JP LaPointe with the Tsokotin National Government, who are sharing information from their experience with Gibraltar that discharges mine wastewater into the Fraser River. As part of our podcast series on salmon connections and resilience, we explore the potential impacts of mining on salmon watersheds in this episode. A number of us collaborated on a science and policy paper that reviewed some of the ecological complexities of rivers and some of the risks mines can have on salmon watersheds. First, we'll hear from Dr. Jonathan Moore from Simon Fraser University about some of the learnings from this collaborative research.
Yeah, mining is a very prevalent industrial activity across the range of salmon. And of course, mining is, you know, generates minerals or materials that are really important for society. But this big review project that had experts from, lots of different sectors and lots of different areas really showcased some of the challenges and some of the needs for thinking about mining into the future. And so first of all, one of the things that was brought to light is we tried to compile information on the extent of mining. And so, For example, in the region of northwestern North America that we sort of focused on from BC and up and some of the northern states, there's over 3,600 mines that have been operated over the last 150 years or so. So there's a lot of activity. And what we've also found is that in looking into this, there are many examples of how mines have severely harmed salmon populations or their habitat, severely harmed them. However, what we also found is that it was just impossible to comprehensively understand the full suite of impacts of mining. The data just wasn't organized. It wasn't available. And so there is just a lot of data black holes. There's a lot that could have been learned, but isn't available for learning from. And so those are some of the key things that we learned in that collaborative project.
Right, and there are some recommendations that were made, but were for going forward.
Yeah, and so given those findings, we also looked at sort of mining policies in light of our understanding of how salmon watersheds work. And there are some things that I think we really need to be thinking about. And so, for example, the risks of mining might be underestimated in some cases, as climate change might exacerbate the risks or push systems into new places or stress, mining technology. Again, cumulative effects of different land uses, as well as the different activities that are associated with mining, the roads that go with them, or the dust or the explosives, and other pathways. And so I think, one of the key findings is that the risks there's danger that the risks of mining are being underestimated. And so what that means is that there's a need for an opportunity for improvement. There's a need and opportunity for improvement for better foundations of science into mining governance and policy. Mm-hmm. So some of those recommendations were that, you know, overall, there continues to be work done to fold science into mining policy. Some examples of how that could look is there should be improved transparency and organization of mining impact data. Mining impact data can be proprietary, and so it isn't always shared, and it's definitely not sort of organized in a way that's accessible easily. And so again, I think that's a real missed opportunity to learn from what's been done in the past. So that's one key recommendation. Another key recommendation is that mining projects are oftentimes examined in isolation. And so a given mine will be proposed, and then it'll go through an environmental assessment. And that environmental assessment aims to try to quantify the environmental risks of that specific project. As mentioned before, those environmental assessments might not characterize the true full risks. And so that's a concern, and there's real need for increased work on that. But then also there's a need for thinking about, well, how do we make these decisions that so they're not in isolation? You know, it's probably not one mine that's happening in the region. It's probably many, and it's not the only human activity in the region. And so there's a need for forward-looking planning, whether it's regional plans or watershed plans, but the plans that are made in ways that incorporate the different priorities and values of the people that live there, priorities and values that could be, you know, benefited or harmed by the mine. And so that sort of forward-looking planning process is a key need as well.
This might not have been part of the paper, but we've but I know you've looked at this a little bit. We have a near where I live here on Wet'suwet'en territory, there's a Telkwa coal mine that's being proposed. And, you know, again, as you said, you know, doesn't take into account the equity silver legacy that's further up that requires mm-hmm. water treatment in perpetuity, which is forever. And, you know, inadequate studies in terms of steelhead and some of the salmon habitat in their environmental assessment thing. But in attending an open house, you know, I asked about some of those salmon habitat impacts, and the guy that, the proponent responded by saying, oh, you know, don't worry, we're gonna create some new habitat. In fact, there'll be a net gain mm-hmm. of fish habitat. And I know you've looked a little bit about that. I just think nature creates habitat so much better than we humans do. And also I think sometimes this, like, maybe they're going to build a pond and fill it with trout or something. Like, it's not even going to be salmon habitat that they're replacing. I don't know if that's true, but I know you've looked a little bit about effectiveness of some of that.
A lot of projects and a lot of mining projects justify their approval through habitat mitigation. And so the idea is that the harm will be compensated by creation of habitat elsewhere. Science shows that that has a real high failure rate, to be blunt. And so it just, in a lot of cases, that's probably unlikely to actually succeed. And then I think another challenge is that sometimes that mitigation technology is unproven. And so, you know, there can be, it's like, oh, trust me, this will work. And sometimes it doesn't. And, right. and that's a real, that's happened, and that's a real risk. And so I think it is really important and challenging for the true risks to get brought to light when there are some of these practices of, you know, relying on habitat compensation that might not work, or unproven mitigation technology that seem like they're common in the field, but, you know, have real challenges from a scientific validity perspective. Thank you.
In the study, more than 3,600 active and abandoned mines were identified in Western North America, many situated at some of the most valuable salmon habitat in the Pacific region. Chris Sargent is a research scientist at Flathead Lake Biological Station and one of the other lead authors who pulled together this interdisciplinary research.
At the most basic level, what's really clear to me as someone who's been studying mining impacts now for about 4 years, is how interdisciplinary the issue is. You can't just be a salmon biologist or a mine engineer or a policy expert. You really need all of those people. You need hydrologists, geomorphologists. Mines have the potential to impact all different parts of a watershed, terrestrial and aquatic, and it really is an interdisciplinary problem, very complicated. So I'm glad for our paper that we were able to bring together so many people with those expertise and synthesize something. And we really found that there was no existing scientific work that really connected, like, how do salmon watersheds work ecologically? How do mines work? How they operate? How they overlap with salmon? And then based on that overlap, what are the impacts? And based on those impacts, what kind of policy insights do we have? And so to be able to put that all together with 23 people with different expertise is really, really cool. Go ahead, Nikki. Sorry.
No, and I was just going to say, and you definitely helped really spearhead that research. So that was much appreciated.
We all got together October 2019. It was probably the most fun workshop I've ever been a part of. It was a really great kickoff. And speaking of that workshop, you know, what I think of as one of the key learnings is, you know, if you remember, we really envisioned that this paper would look at, you know, what kind of impacts were predicted during environmental impacts process, right? Impact assessment process. Then did those actually come true after the mining project started? And so can we compare before and after, say, water quality? And what I found and others as we worked on the paper is that really that was a nearly impossible task. A lot of the data aren't available or we don't know how they were collected. And so doing this before and after impact assessment, which is so critical and kind of a basic need in mining and river research. We could only find one study that had done this, which we cite. And in that case, they found that 16 of 25 mines they studied had worse water quality than predicted during the impact assessment process. So that really, to me, points to the need to do a better job assessing before and after impacts. And we just aren't quite there yet with the kind of data we need from, you know, publicly. So
yeah, I know, like in British Columbia, it's a real challenge because it's often the proponent that, you know, hires a firm or whatever to do that water quality and quantity and flow baseline data. That becomes part of it, but there's all sorts of kind of, yeah, like you said, not necessarily consistent collection or public access to data, or those, as you mentioned, a lot of that post-monitoring work.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm always careful to point out that the folks on the ground there collecting those data are good scientists. They're doing a good job. But where I think what we point out in the paper is a couple of different things. There should be more spread between the proponent, as you say, and the people collecting the data. There should be more independence there. And I don't think it should take a Freedom of Information Act request or deep technical knowledge to kind of extract the data you need for your own critical assessment of the mines and what they, and then currently that's kind of the state of affairs, is you have to put a lot of effort in, you know, like these, you've seen these EA or EIS documents, they're hundreds or thousands of pages, and they're not in an easily summarizable format. And I think that needs to change and be better for scientists like us to be able to kind of make our own independent judgments of water quality and other metal contamination, things like that.
Yeah. And can you share some other learnings from that research or some other findings and recommendations?
Yeah. In a similar thing to what we've been talking about, I think monitoring programs in general need to be designed to take more measurements. I think what we were finding is that even with the data we have, detecting trends like whether water's leaking from a tailings reservoir dam or whether metal contamination is going up over time. Right now, monitoring is not high resolution enough, monthly or quarterly at a site. And that's not really high enough to get a trend over time. We'd really love to see more like daily or weekly measurements. I think, you know, we did a little bit of digging into reclamation bond estimates and how, you know, in BC or Alaska or any of the jurisdictions we included in that study, which is kind of across Northwestern North America, in some places like Alaska, you're required to put the full bond amount up before the project starts. In BC, there's kind of this, and you're well familiar with this, of course, Nikki could speak to it better than me, but there's kind of this sliding scale of where you put portions of the full reclamation amount in over time. And it doesn't have to be fully in before the project starts. And we found a hard time. We found it hard to figure out how the full reclamations were estimated. We didn't find those estimates, derivations consistent for mine size or easy to interpret, or where I could kind of look at a detailed list of like, here's how all these costs add up. And there's a really, I think there's a chance that most of these bond estimates are underestimated and may not cover the full cost of reclamation at the end of a project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is problematic. I think, yeah, and around that, there's a whole bunch of challenging issues from, as you mentioned, how the estimates are made and the need for verification, some of the sort of discounts provided along the way, and then the ability for mines to kind of stay in care and maintenance without kind of any guidelines and, you know, sort of postponing reclamation or decreasing risks of tailings failures and that sort of thing. So, definitely an issue. And then we have all these legacy mines, like going back up to the northwest there, Tulsiquitchief mine that has been leaking acid mine drainage for 65 plus years or whatever. It was just this like really small remote mine that now has a price tag of $50 to $100 million to deal with, you know, basically treatment in perpetuity forever to sort of clean up some of that pollution.
And that one is just a pinky toenail version compared to some of the really large mines that are either operating or proposed in the region, right? I mean, very, very small, and it's been hard to clean up. So that's one of my personal concerns. And I think we point out in the paper is that a lot of the modern day mines are truly engineering marvels, have a lot of uncertainty and risk. And if we're estimating $50 to $100 million to clean up Tulsiquitchief mine, what's the true cleanup cost of these mines that might be hundreds of times bigger?
Yeah, good point. And here we are speaking on the unfortunate anniversary of the Mount Polley mine disaster that happened 8 years ago.
What are
some of the recommendations for going forward, given that mining is occurring?
Yeah, we came out with, you know, in the paper, we stray a little bit from recommendations and add more of like things to consider or important points to discuss for individual mines, to acknowledge the fact that some places are doing better than others in these regards, right? So In the paper, we point out a few things. Placer mining, which is, you know, removing kind of surface sediments to mine for metals, that is less regulated, less transparent than major mine projects, and it's hard in a lot of the jurisdictions we covered to know which ones are active, how much sediment they're removing from stream channels, things like that. So we recommend better transparency and centralized information for placer mines. For major mining projects, especially those across international jurisdictions, which some of us refer to as transboundary watersheds, in places where these don't already exist, there should be an automatic trigger for kind of watershed scale planning and assessment that looks at large areas and what's the future and scenarios for mining in the future. It's kind of as opposed to what's a case by case basis of cumulative effects and watershed scale planning. So kind of, you know, visionary processes that set out the whole landscape. Where do we want to conserve places for salmon and other wildlife? Where do we want to have mining? Where is mining a no-go? Things like that. In some places, those exist, and others, they don't. So we think that should be an automatic trigger for especially the major mining projects.
Mm-hmm.
Another, I think, is very important is in terms of mitigation technology, right? We bring up how climate change is really changing what scientists refer to as stationarity. And stationarity is this assumption that you can take measurements of, say, air temperature or precipitation right now, calculate kind of the maximum and minimum range of rainfall over time and say, well, we know what that is. So now we can engineer something that can withstand that variability. But what we're finding is that now there's non-stationarity where that minimum and maximum are relatively meaningless. We're seeing records broken all the time and more frequently for extreme events, whether it's heat or rainfall or snowpack or landslides or whatever. So it's really causing a lot of engineering challenges. And it's important to make sure that mitigation that's proposed for a mine, whether it's water quality treatment or a dam design, is really taking that future uncertainty into account. I can't speak well in engineering language, but you know what we say in the paper is that despite modern day impact assessment processes, which have improved right over time, there are still though examples of big mines failing. We point out Red Dog Mine in Alaska, which has been in operation since 1989, that there was unforeseen permafrost thaw a couple of years ago that overwhelmed their water treatment and diversion facilities. They had to spend tens of billions of dollars upgrading. And we just see, again, a lot of engineering marvels that pose a lot of risk. And we see a need for kind of better transparency and acknowledgement of the kind of climate change future and what that means for whether these mitigation technologies will actually continue working for a long, long time.
Yeah. And what we know in BC is that, like, if you, through the Canadian Dam Association, if your tailings dam facility is rated extreme or high, then you do actually, you know, have to plan out for that 10,000 year flooding event or what have you, but you don't if it's under that classification. And so we think that all mines should be required. And as you mentioned, you know, what happens when there's the multiple or back-to-back significant events or these extremes, right? So we had like the heat dome and then atmospheric rivers and all sorts of climate calamities last year. That really puts stresses and risks on the system. I think you're right though. I think, you know, I mean, that's always sort of that idea of, you know, we know we will have some mining. How do we improve the conditions around that, but also have that sort of planning lens so that, you know, we establish clear no-go zones for the other values like water quality and wildlife and salmon. So, you know, that's why we advocate for those mining law reform changes, really.
Ultimately, We need to reduce impacts from mining to salmon watersheds because they impact cultures and communities and ecosystems reliant on healthy salmon. We caught up with Noosk Mata at the welcoming back of the salmon barbecue in Whitsett in July on a very windy day, and she shares some of these impacts with us.
It's tough though, like especially around the Fraser River because of the Mount Polly mine disaster. You've got Gibraltar mines. There's all these mines and cities that dump their so-called treated sewage into the systems, and the fish have to swim through all of this. So like I haven't eaten fish from the Fraser River in years. There's too much worry in that fish, you know. And so I have been fortunate to receive sockeye from the Skeena and to harvest springs and coho mostly in the Bella Coola River. But, you know, it's really tough. Like, you have to really ration it out. It's not like before where you would have so much that you would, you know, have for your family to eat weekly, you know, three times a week or whatever, you know, you wanted. And then now it's like, okay, it's a special occasion. We get to eat fish. Very different. Yeah, our feasts in the interior don't include fish anymore. It's too precious. We can't share it. We don't have enough to share anymore. We're really feeling the pressure to organize in our communities to raise that awareness and to really push back on all the predators out there of, you know, the commercial fishing industry, the fish farms, commercial logging that's impacting habitat, you know, industrial mining that's impacting watersheds as well. So it's like this really big cumulative story, and it's the same everywhere, despite what the extractive industry might be. They're all connected, hydroelectric dams, everything. It's all part of this industrial extraction complex that is impacting the salmon.
There are some things within our control when it comes to salmon health. Other than the broader need to reduce climate impacts, we can reduce harvests and improve fisheries management. We can protect and restore fish habitat, and we can prevent toxic and industrial impacts to salmon watersheds. This includes creating some buffers and no-go zones and preventing mine pollution from entering these river systems. Ultimately, we want to avoid cumulative effects and adding stressors to salmon that are such an important part of the cultures and communities of the Taku, Stikine, Nass, Skeena, Fraser, and other watersheds in British Columbia. While a low-carbon future will depend on some mined materials, we need to better assess whether current and future mining projects are operating in such a way that protects salmon and well-functioning watersheds. We can and must do better.
Thank you so much for listening to this 54 Degrees North podcast, Salmon Connections and Resilience series. This episode was recorded on the unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en in the months of July and August 2022. Lassise, J.P. Lapointe, Jonathan Moore, Chris Sargent, and Noosk Mata for interviews, insights, and for your contributions to strengthening our salmon systems. Thank you to Los Gringos Salvajes for the music. Thank you to Facundo Gastiazoro for the art. This podcast is produced by Nikki Skuse with production and editing assistance by Namita Prakash. Thanks to the Canada Summer Jobs Program for helping make this podcast possible. The 54 Degrees North podcast is available for download on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Chocolate se armó.